Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Mary South is the author of a short story collection called You Will Never Be Forgotten. It's her debut. The stories feature characters trying to use technology to escape their uncontrollable feelings of grief, rage, or despair. Mary uses carefully crafted sentences and a fair share of dark humor to show that the results aren't always what her characters hoped for. Mary joined us from her home in New York City. A brief word of warning, our conversation deals with adult themes, including rape and suicide. Here's Mary reading an excerpt from a story called Frequently Asked Questions About Your Craniotomy.
I feel betrayed by the brain. The brain is more or less the same in everyone. There's the Broca's area, that cul-de-sac of speech in the arcuate vesiculus, and there's the hippocampus, that seahorse of memory, nestled in the temporal lobe. But when you think of the color red, do you picture the insistent primal red of an emergency vehicle, or the deep burgundy of an aged wine? If I asked you to visualize a chair, would you picture an ornately carved dining chair or a plush recliner? Similarly, I thought my husband was predictable. I knew which entree he would order at restaurants, which jokes would elicit a laugh. Then I found my husband in the garage after his suicide by gunshot to the head, and our relationship no longer made sense. I assumed I had known the locations and boundaries of things, where he tended to take off his shoes, the weekend afternoons he liked to be left alone. The older brother he used to idolize had overdosed. My husband was sad, and after a while I became exasperated with him because I assumed that I understood where the edges of that sadness were. Now I wonder, when I am resecting a brain to prevent seizures, for example, what am I even attempting to fix?
All 10 of your short stories in this collection explore how technology affects our relationships. What is it about this theme that you find so interesting to write about?
One of the things that really interests me about technology is that no matter how much it advances, no matter how instantaneously we can get the news or how much information we now have than ever before, that our baseline, like human emotions and human psyche, hasn't changed. So,
yeah, so the it's kind of what you're going with. What it seems to me what you're doing in your stories, like, yeah, you as you mentioned, technology evolves, and then our relationships with people's relationships with technology evolve too, and people, depending on the technology and the person's experience with it, they may evolve too in different ways. Would that be fair to say?
Yeah, I grew up with technology as a millennial woman, still like with a dial-up modem, and just seeing it change over time, so that it's gone from these slow speeds where you're like getting an image downloaded into your computer, like just like a bit at a time, to now like we're getting these updates about the news like instantaneously and commentary about it instantaneously. I'm interested like how that sort of reroutes our psychology, but then we're still like our emotions and our needs are still baseline the same. We still crave acceptance and nurturing and connection with others. So, but now that we have these like amazing tools at our disposal, how do we go about getting them? When we have like an app, a dating app, where you can meet hundreds of people that you would never have been able to meet before in your life, how do you go and adjust your behavior, go about getting that and fulfilling that need? Because the baseline need for connection and touch and all of that is the same. I'm interested to see like how those like core yearnings like then get expressed through technology.
Mm-hmm, yeah. You've said that you don't want your stories to become all premise. You really want them to be complex and nuanced, which is hard to do when it comes to the internet. So how do you go about doing that?
Again, it's like trying to ground the story and the character's emotions, trying to ground it in where they're coming from, to really imagine them fully in my mind and how they would respond to situations in their life. My stories have often been compared to the show Black Mirror, and that's a show I really I do enjoy. I enjoy some episodes of it more than others, but the episodes that I really do enjoy are the ones where they really are grounded in the character's emotions. So it doesn't just become like a story about like, oh, this is how we have no more privacy anymore, or this is how social media makes us lose empathy for each other. It's really about like, here's a character struggling with like a core trauma or a core desire that they've never been able to fulfill in their life. And like, Now, how are they going to go about getting that when they have all of these tools? It really goes back to the character and their emotions. For example, in my book, I have a story called Not Setsuko, and it's about a mother who has lost her daughter tragically, so she clones her and then tries to remake her memories so she can live in the illusion that she has the same child back. The story is not really about cloning, although that's like a futuristic, near futuristic technology, human cloning. I could have made the choice to like go further into that and explore that world and, you know, how people clone children or clone relatives or lost loved ones. But really, I wanted to stay grounded with the mother and her desire to have her child back. I really wanted the story to be about grief.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Let's talk about the title story, You Will Never Be Forgotten. What can you tell us about this one?
So this story is one of the most tech-focused stories in the book. It's about a woman who is working for, she never calls it out by name, she calls it the world's most popular search engine throughout the story, but it's essentially Google. She's working as a content moderator, screening traumatic and violent content from, so it's the public, general public will hopefully not see it. At the same time, she is also monitoring her rapist as he is living his life online, seeing like what he's posting on social media. And she starts also monitoring him in real life, like following him around the neighborhood after he goes home from work and that kind of thing. And it's mostly because she's trying to process the trauma of her sexual assault, but also like she's worried that what happened to her is going to happen to other women. So there's a lot emotionally for her to deal with.
Yeah. Could you read an excerpt for us and set it up, please?
This excerpt is in the middle of the story. The woman has made a fake profile on the dating site where she originally met the rapist, and she has been corresponding with him. But then the whole thing seems really false and wrong. So she confesses, like, this is me. This is the woman you sexually assaulted. Do you remember me? And then, of course, he doesn't ever respond. So this is what happens after that. Anxious since hitting send, the woman stares at her messages, waiting for something to happen, while she tries to determine what she hoped to accomplish with this fake profile and correspondence scheme. Did she want the rapist to acknowledge that he is a rapist? An apology? Professions of love? For him to kill himself? What she gets is nothing. The rapist ghosts. Her need for a reply, even if only a nasty one, becomes more and not less urgent. She follows the rapist online and in real life with greater persistence. She rereads each digital clue left by the rapist and then rereads the rereads. She watches him take lunches, do drinks, socialize. She watches him train for his next charity triathlon, buy bright new curtains, over which she wishes she could but can't make a curtains matching the drapes quip, walk his dog, recycle, be a well-adjusted individual and valuable member of the community. Confrontation is her fantasy of knocking on the rapist's door and when he opens it, bluntly informing him, "Hi, you raped me."
Thank you. That was great. The protagonist in this story is dealing with a lot of trauma, the trauma of being raped and the traumatic images that she has to watch in her job as a content moderator. So it makes me wonder, was this a difficult story for you to write?
It was difficult. All of that is really sensitive material, and I didn't want to re-traumatize the reader by the way I dealt with it. But then again, I also thought it was important if I was going to write about these things that I like fully look at them and not shy away from writing about them, like how fully difficult they can be. What I ended up doing with the content moderation is like I didn't want to go into detail about like the specifics of these videos and how horrible they are. I just tried to describe it when I was introducing the fact that this is the woman's job, just sort of very straightforwardly as I could. And then with her sexual assault, of course, like, I don't want to glamorize that or, you know, sensationalize that. What I hope I accomplished was by grounding it in her emotions and her point of view and her struggle to get over it, I hope that the reader can really feel her pain. It's really about her pain and recovery. I wanted to fully inhabit her and fully present her to the world and do her justice and like have her be seen in the way that she feels very invisible. her rapist hasn't been held accountable. So I wanted that character to be fully seen and sort of have her justice in a fictional way.
Yeah. And I think you accomplished that very well. You take on fandom in a story called To Save the Universe, We Must Also Save Ourselves. Can you tell us a bit about this story?
Yeah, so this is written in the collective third person, we, a voice of the internet. And I've been watching online. I'm on social media and on Twitter and Instagram. And I've just seen how certain fandoms can like sort of tear apart the thing that they love. They can tear apart actresses or television shows or comics or anything like that. And sort of destroy the thing that gives them the most pleasure. And I think the internet is a huge vehicle for that. It just made me really upset to see it happen and to see, I think we forget when we're on the internet that actresses and people who make these shows are real people. You know, it's easy to forget that there's not these products that appear to us, that appear in our Netflix, things that we have to consume. And so I really wanted to like show that this woman, this particular actress who's the star of this sci-fi show, is like a real person who is like dealing with like this toxic fandom constantly judging her and constantly putting her in a position where she has to defend herself and has caused extreme like emotional stress for her. So I hope that I showed that, but also had some like humor and levity in how I dealt with the internet, because the internet can also be sometimes very funny.
Mm-hmm. As your work, your stories are often very funny. There's a lot of dark humor in them, and that's another, you know, another layer, another level on which to appreciate them. As you mentioned, you've written this story from the point of view of we, which makes it so much more powerful. I can't imagine it being written in any other point of view, because by using we, you're emphasizing the mob mentality that fandom is often subject to. So I'm curious about how you go about choosing point of view for that you're going to use for each particular story that you write.
Yeah, it's a really sort of intuitive process. The we is like looking at the internet, like trying to get that sort of mob mentality that grows, and thinking like, okay, well, what point of view could possibly accomplish this? And so like, okay, then you use a collective third person we for the title story. It's also third person, but it's really, really close. And I ended up settling on that particular point of view because I wanted to show the woman's dissociation. She doesn't even have a name. And I had some early readers say, like, well, why don't you put it in first person? And why don't you give her a name? You know, it's really her story. We're in her point of view kind of anyway. I thought about it for a long time because, you know, I really do want her to be seen in the story. But for me, it's like what she's going through is a dissociation from her trauma. And so even though she wants the rapist to be held accountable, she also feels protective of herself and the need to hide a little bit. So it's about invisibility and visibility. So having it in a third person voice with no name for her or the man who sexually assaulted her, I thought accomplished that. You know, other times I do enjoy writing in just first-person stories, though, and fully inhabiting the characters, the I voice of, like, you know, saying how they really feel outright.
Mm-hmm. Mary South, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Mary South is the author of the short story collection You Will Never Be Forgotten. Find out more about Mary at wpr.org/beta.
Ultimately, what I had to do is treat myself like a client, treat my own project with the same level of seriousness that I would give to Natasha or Penn or Aziz's projects.
Film and TV composer Joel Wong joins us to talk about his debut solo album. That's coming up in just a moment. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio.